After these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined by his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hated bird. With the phrase, after these things, as we were already saying last time, after these things I saw, he shows the change of the vision. A new angel appears, one who has great authority. This reveals not only the power of the angel, if we suppose that he was an agent of the destruction of Rome, the Babylon Rome, but above all, and chiefly the authority and trustworthiness of the prophecy concerning the fall of Rome. At this very pinnacle of her power, it would have been very difficult for a citizen of the Roman Empire to imagine that Rome could ever fall. But what does the angel say? Fallen. Fallen is Babylon, the great. The doubling fallen, fallen, already shows in a prophetic way a foreshadowing of the fall of Rome, and it is a preparation for the judgment that he already announced in the 14th chapter, and now returns to in the 18th chapter. This gradual unfolding of the judgment shows not merely a preparation of the reader, as is the custom in Hebrew literature, but that this gradual judgment is indeed carried out within history. Besides, a judgment, forgive me, a fall is never sudden but progressive. Perhaps old Rome, forgive me, old Babylon, fell within a single night, but its fall had been foretold. Not only because the Hebrew prophets had already proclaimed it, both Isaiah and Jeremiah, Isaiah much earlier, long before the first Babylonian captivity, and Jeremiah during the Babylonian captivity of the Hebrews, but as much and chiefly because there was the corruption of the city. And it was precisely this corruption of the city that had foretold its fall. The same thing happened with the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, and with the Roman, and with the Byzantine, and in all the empires that have ever existed upon the earth, their fall was foretold chiefly by their corruption. Indeed, if you like, the fall of Constantinople, which happened in the 15th century, was not a sudden fall. Anyone who reads a little history sees this plainly. Rather, it was a fall that had been foretold for many decades, if not for two centuries. Indeed, many had already observed that Constantinople was by then only a city, no longer an empire, because, as an empire, it had lost all its territories and had been left with only the city. The whole empire, the Byzantine, was only a single city, nothing else, and this city would fall. They foretold it, they could see it. So we see here that there is nothing sudden, and that the decay and fall of Europe, that is, of the European states, this too was already noted in the past century. Spengler, for example, says that Europe is now in decline because it is soaked through with immorality, and the historical spirit foretells the decay and fall of the European peoples, and we can see it for ourselves. Europe truly is passing through a decline. Already the fall of America is being noted by the Americans themselves. There is a great deal of corruption. And years ago I was reading about a senator who, while speaking at the podium and referring to the rotting of American youth, fainted from his sorrow, seeing America, the United States, already being led toward destruction and decay. We might say that today, the whole world is ready to fall, the whole world, both the East and the West, because the element of decay exists in all the peoples of the earth. Humanity has ripened for its fall, so as to be made ready to be conquered by the Antichrist. What are the criteria by which we recognize this fall of the peoples? Just as with ancient Babylon and the Babylon Rome. It is atheism, it is amoralism, that is, the blunting of the criterion of morality. There is no longer any sense of morality. People say to you, what is morality even supposed to mean? And then there is strenos, which the text I read to you names as a criterion. I will read it to you again, and we will analyze it a little further on. It says, a little further down, that the merchants of the earth grew rich from the strenos. Eta, eta, with a circumflex, from the strenos of Babylon, of this harlot city. What can one say? Strenos is a word that in itself is rare in the New Testament. There exists, however, the verb katastreniazo, and it has the following meaning, which I beg you to note, because it is a very characteristic word that expresses the contemporary condition of humanity. According to the dictionary, it means arrogance of life, It is the luxury and abundance of material goods. It is wastefulness, always according to the dictionary. Further, a second meaning of the word strenos is licentiousness and indulgence in pleasure, a hedonism. And a third meaning is ardent desire and longing, but a carnal longing, a lower longing, a baser desire. Remember this analysis of the word strenos. It is very characteristic. So there are three elements that predetermine the fall of all the peoples of the earth. Atheism, amoralism, that is, the absence of every moral element, and strenos. Because all these elements of the arrogance of life, he has a car, so I will have one too. You live well, so I will live well too. And we try to outdo one another. In this luxury, in this we call it consumer society. That is, what we call the abundance of material goods, this wastefulness, this indulgence, this pleasure. Just watch how a woman smokes her cigarette. Only that. I do not say a man. I do not say a man. How a woman smokes her cigarette. And you will draw many conclusions only from the cigarette. That pleasure she feels when she smokes, taking delight in the smoking. This image alone is an indicator of what exactly exists within the modern world as katastreniasmos. This strenos, of course, the voice of the angel, which said, fallen, fallen is Babylon, the great, is a prophetic aorist. When it says, fallen, it is because she had not yet fallen, but would fall, a prophetic aorist. Nevertheless, historically, Rome did fall. Indeed, at the beginning of the 5th century, as I told you last time, in the year 410, it was devastated to the utmost degree by Alaric, and also by still other barbarians, the Franks, the Goths, and so on, who plundered Rome again and again, and Rome fell. But like every Babylon Rome, it will fall within history, and it foreshadows its own fall by the stance it takes toward God and his kingdom. The fall of Babylon Rome is not confined to the fall alone. The city is also turned into a dwelling place of demons, as the sacred text says here, and into a prison, a nest, for every unclean spirit and for every flesh-eating bird that is loathsome under the law. According to the Hebrew understanding, desolate places were always dwelling places of evil spirits. At first glance, it means to show that the city would be left so desolate that it would become a dwelling place of demons. Something like this, my beloved, happened literally, quite literally, in ancient Babylon. The first one, we might say, the prototype, Babylon, the Babylon of Mesopotamia, the one whose king was Nebuchadnezzar, the city that Nebuchadnezzar the Great truly adorned and beautified and made great. This ancient Babylon is a type of every city that lives according to its own conduct. Indeed, this ancient Babylon became a place of habitation for the demons, for every demonic spirit, many times, because perhaps this gives rise to a question. How can it possibly be so? Well, we see a city, it was left desolate. We have a great many ancient cities whose very location we cannot even determine. By chance, sometimes, we may carry out an excavation, or after certain measurements and so on, we may dig and find something. And we would not even have suspected that here there was once a city. That place is a dwelling of the demons. And so, my beloved, many times ascetics, Christian ascetics, encountered demons in desolate places there, where idolatrous shrines had first been established, or where there had been places of terrible licentiousness. These places of excessive licentiousness and idolatry present a kind of acquired rights of the demons. That is, the demons have certain acquired rights in these places. And so very often we see people, ascetics as I told you, who confirmed this. They would go into the desert to a place where there had once been an ancient city or an ancient temple. And there they would encounter demons in abundance. Demons can even take up residence within a person, even in his remains, in his very bones. Do not be alarmed, of course, by what I am telling you. But it is a reality. Once an ascetic found a skull in the desert without knowing whose it was, and he placed it under his head as a pillow to sleep. And he heard voices coming from within the skull, the voices of the demons. And this skull, according to the testimony of the demons, belonged to an idolatrous priest, by which they showed their acquired rights over these remains of this man. And the ascetic opened a dialogue with the demons that were nested there in this skull. So indeed we can say that what the sacred evangelist says in the Apocalypse, that it will become a place of demons and also a nest for every flesh-eating bird that is loathsome under the law. Under the law, as for instance, the ravens. The raven is not a loathsome creature in itself. It is one of God's birds, but under the law, because according to the law it was among the unclean animals. In this sense, it is called a loathsome creature, from the legal standpoint, not the ontological one, the legal. And so we might say there is this desolation in that place where there had been an abundance of idolatry and an abundance of licentiousness. But there is also a metaphorical desolation, the desolation from the grace of God. The city may still stand, the ancient city, just as we might say ancient Rome, still exists today. It is the capital of Italy, Rome, the Rome we know. And indeed, Rome is one of the great cities of the world. Here we could say many times that a city may be desolate of the grace of God. Here perhaps I will hear the objection, namely, is present-day Rome, today's Rome, desolate of the grace of God. I will not answer. The progress of this talk will perhaps show something. In ancient Rome, the one that was a persecutor of Christians, the Church of Rome, was founded, to which the Apostle, with many words of praise, sends his epistle, bearing its name, his epistle to the Romans. Yet, in this great city that existed there, the church, the renowned Church of Rome, but the Church of Rome, over the course of the centuries, betrayed its mission, forgot the apostolic commands, the very church that was able to teach all the other churches, even the Church of Corinth. St. Clement of Rome sent two letters to the Christians of Corinth. St. Clement of Rome belongs to the second century, and because quarrels had broken out in the Church of Corinth, he reminds them of the visit of the great Paul, who founded the Church of Rome, and who in his letters speaks of the theme of love. If, he says, I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have no love, I am nothing, I am nothing. And St. Clement points out to them, you have forgotten the love that the Apostle reminds you of. So we have these very long, very beautiful letters of St. Clement of Rome to the Church of Corinth. The Church of Rome was renowned. It brought forth many saints. It gave many martyrs. Thousands, millions of martyrs the Church of Rome gave. I told you once before that the most renowned and the finest letter of Paul, which is called the Gospel, according to Paul, is the letter to the Romans. But, as I told you, over the course of the centuries Rome, the Church of Rome betrayed her calling. She too, in her turn, forgot the apostolic commands. I could, of course, point to specific moments in history, but I don't need to do that right now. She walked together with idolatrous Rome and truly presents a textbook example. A textbook example, especially with the capture of Rome under the Frank. A textbook example of a secularized church. I underline it and say it again. A textbook example of a secularized church. A church that became worldly. Yet the church must not be made worldly. Rather, the world must be brought into the church. This very same course, within a very brief historical sketch, was followed by the Church of New Rome as well. That is, Constantinople, many times. My dear ones, Constantinople too. The New Rome flirted with worldly power. And many times, for the sake of that worldly power, she betrayed her mission. And so, many times, she drove out or exiled her great and holy patriarchs. I will limit myself to mentioning only two examples, that of John Chrysostom and that of St. Gregory the Theologian. Only two examples, so as not to speak of so many other cases. This Aretas of the 9th century saw fit to compare New Rome, Constantinople, with Old Rome regarding the matter of conduct, and to note that New Rome shows the same conduct that the old, idolatrous Rome had shown. And so New Rome was stripped of her flock, little by little, down through the centuries, and we arrive at our own time. He says she has no ground, pay attention to me. She no longer has any ground on which to shepherd the churches. Already from the 7th century, my dear ones, she lost the eastern provinces. Damascus, St. John of Damascus, when he is already a Christian and is a great father. The region where St. John of Damascus lives, that is, Syria, is no longer within the territory of the Byzantine Empire. It is Arabs. It is Arabs. And so New Rome, Constantinople, loses her ground, that is, she loses her flock, and whatever has remained, to her, up to today. She now becomes a leader of a Christianity that is this pan-heresy and a secularized Christianity. She becomes a leader, dragging the other Orthodox Christian churches along with her as well. So much for New Rome, Constantinople. All of this is happening in our own days. We see all of this. It is in our own days. These are not things we have to go back to the books to find. They are already being carried out. The same thing happened with the Third Rome, Moscow. And she in turn, over the course of the centuries, suffered these same betrayals. And she in turn came to succeed the Second and the First Rome, and to prove by her conduct that she was the Second Rome. But above all, the First Rome, through the persecutions of Christians in our own century, when communism took power. In a small work by Innocent, the Russian Bishop of Novgorod, of the province of Novgorod. This Inokeny, I have this little book with me. One of you gentlemen gave it to me a little while ago, wrote it right after the Russian Revolution, and one of our own archimandrites translated it, Sophronios Doukas, who was a parish priest in Christov in Romania. It appeared here in Greece in 1935, and he writes, my dear ones, the following. Now, he is trying to interpret a few passages of the Apocalypse, not the whole book of Revelation, only certain passages, and he wants to show how what the book of the Apocalypse describes is being fulfilled, how it is being worked out in our own day and in our own age through the persecution of the Church of Christ by those powers that exist as forces set against God. No, something more. A relationship between the red beast and the harlot who rides upon the red beast. And who could this harlot be who rides upon the red beast? But listen, it is better that I read it to you, and you will be astonished. This is not a serpent, it is not a beast, having nothing in common with men, that is, it is not an organization that has nothing in common with Christianity, but it is a human being, and indeed a human being, who is a luxurious woman, adorned with sumptuous attire, and with precious jewels. This woman signifies a Christian organization, but not a naked, ugly, and disfigured one. It remains, not heretical in general, not primarily heretical, but on the contrary, clothed in sumptuous garments, having special institutions, a famous worship, and forms. Yes, it is the living church, the harlot, the living church. This same organization appeared recently in Russia, under the dominion there, of the Red Dragon. What is this? Living Church. It is the union of Christianity with Red Atheism. A union. Sadly, those who considered themselves representatives of Christianity, ministers of God, the clergy, became servants of Satan. While in name they remained ministers of God. Here is how the Living Church came to be formed. The atheist socialists in Russia declared war against God. They began to close the monasteries and the churches. They began to persecute, to torture, and to shoot bishops and priests with no regard for what anyone believed. Then, certain priests of the former established church, the Orthodox Church in Russia, turned to the Red Authority, to the Bolsheviks. With a question, why is the clergy being persecuted? The Red Authority answered, because the clergy served the Tsarist power, and so appears as an enemy of the Red Communist power and an enemy of socialism. The priests who had come forward replied that, on those terms, they were willing to serve the Soviet power as well, so long as they were granted the very rights they had held under the Tsars. The Soviet power then answered that it agreed to grant them any rights at all, but on the condition that they work for the benefit of the Red Atheist power, to the harm of all the enemies of that power, and toward the abolition and the wiping out of the Christian religion. The priests of the former established church answered that they agreed to all of this. So at once, right after this, they separated themselves from Tikhon, the Patriarch of Moscow, and on their own formed an association, a fellowship, which they named the Living Church. And by this road, the richly adorned woman was shown to be a harlot, seated upon the Red Dragon. The representatives of Christ made an alliance with the servants of the devil for the wiping out of Christianity. The Living Church set up a synod, and the godless Soviet authority ratified it, placing it under the higher administration of the general political offices. The GPU, that is, a triad, was formed, a committee of three atheists, to keep in contact with the synod which was bound to carry out willingly, to execute every document and every wish of the Red Atheists, that is, of the Soviet authority. And the work of destroying the Christian relics and the holy things of Christianity went, as we commonly say, downhill. The trio of atheists, for example, gives voice to its wish that all the monasteries be closed, and the Synod of the Living Church begs the Soviet authority to close down every monastery. This power then immediately proceeds to carry out the Synod's request. The closing of the monasteries begins, and the dismissal of the monks and the nuns. The churches they turn into hospitals, clubs, theaters, and the like, laments and wailing and tears and groanings, cries of despair and curses, are heard from the faithful. The Red Power calmly answered, "We here are not to blame. It is your own synod that demands this, and we only carry out its wishes." So by this very road they closed many churches, they imprisoned, they exiled to hard labor, and they shot thousands of bishops, priests, and ordinary Christians. The Living Church introduced many innovations. It brought in married priests. It promoted married men to the rank of bishop, and it permits priests to enter a second marriage, while still keeping the rank of their priesthood afterward. Every bishop and priest of the Living Church is at the same time an agent and an informer for the Special Council, the GPU, the higher authority, and they report whatever they know and denounce everyone, whether one of their own or a stranger, who would dare to speak against the Soviet power, against the godless communists. At the wish of this power, and against the canons of the Church, they depose Patriarch Tikhon, and stripped him even of the monastic habit. And how many of these men handed over to the claws of the Red Dragon, to martyrdom and death, it is impossible to number. All the bloodthirsty deeds of the Soviet power, the Living Church, with its petitions, approves and blesses, and the enemies of the Red Serpent it curses. But we must not think that this corrupted woman seated upon the Red Beast pictures only the Living Church of Moscow and the members of that church. No. This we must understand far more broadly. By this harlot are meant all Christians in general, who, wherever they may be, though they remain Christians, labor for the destruction of Christianity and for the benefit of the Red Beast of atheism, whether laymen or priests or bishops and metropolitans and patriarchs and popes. Such men there are, and they are found both in history and in our own days. And much more besides, what can we add? My beloved, to these things. What can we add? You've heard them. We see it in our own days as well. One thing only, that here in our own Greece a beginning has already been made, and may God be our deliverance. I say nothing more. Namely, that we ourselves betray the church, that this harlot woman can be one that goes by the lofty name of church, that is, that she can be such. This we see. And it can also be established by many arguments, and drawn out from many pieces of evidence, both geographical and patristic, which I will set before you next. Remember, in the 11th chapter of the Apocalypse, this passage, "And there was given to me a reed," says the evangelist John, "like a rod, and he said, Rise, measure the temple of God, and the altar, and those who worship in it, and the court which is outside the temple, cast out, and do not measure it. For it has been given to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. Do you not remember this? There, in its proper place, we interpreted that the church, according to the interpretation of the fathers, is the holy city. Jerusalem. The holy evangelist receives the command not to measure the city, because the measuring, as we saw then, is nothing other than the symbol of the protection, under which only the temple and the altar stand, which were in the inner court. The rest of the city, the church, is not protected. Do not measure the rest of it. It is not protected. What is this? It is those who were indeed baptized, laymen and clergy, laymen and clergy. I stress this, but who remained within a worldly secularized church. Father Justin Popovich, a Serb, who has now fallen asleep, blessed in memory, writes in his book Man and the God-Man, and I quote, "Only by its divine human power is Christianity the salt of the earth, the salt that preserves man so that he is not corrupted in sin and evil. But if Christianity is diluted into various humanisms, then it loses its savor. It becomes salt without taste, unsalted salt, which, according to the all-true word of the Savior, is good for nothing except to be cast out and trampled underfoot by men. Every effort, an attempt to equate Christianity with the spirit of this age, with the fleeting movements of certain historical periods, and moreover, to make it fit in with and ally itself to political parties or regimes, strips Christianity of that distinguishing value which makes it a unique God-manhood. A merely human religion in the world, it turns into unsalted salt. Let us note that a church which serves an atheist regime serves it, not merely exists under it. For even in ancient Rome, there was idolatry, and beneath Rome, there was a church, the Church of the Catacombs. But a church that serves the purposes of an atheist regime cannot be a planting from God, a plant planted by God. And as the Lord himself says, every plant that God has not planted will be uprooted. Matthew 15:13. This so-called church, in quotation marks, and this so-called faith, in quotation marks, are the ones that are trampled underfoot by the enemies. As the book of Revelation says, it will be trampled, it says, for 42 months, 3.5 years, it will be trampled underfoot by the enemies. Do not measure it, God says. It is not under my protection. Such a church is not a church. It is not a church. That is to say, the blessing and the protection of God are not there. It is a church only in appearance. I will say this, if it is truly the Church of Christ in Russia, in this case, then why does the true church hide in the catacombs and suffer persecution? We have the upper church and the lower church. If the church is indeed free and does not serve the purposes of the atheist regime, then why does a second, hidden church exist? For what reason? This presence of the hidden church shows that there is a church which has betrayed its mission. And second, the Lord said, because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Do you follow? I'm giving you the grounds for why Bishop Innocent describes this so-called church, in quotation marks, as the harlot seated upon the scarlet beast. So the Lord says, because lawlessness shall abound, the love of many shall grow cold. Matthew 24:12. And among these many of many, it says, shall the love grow cold? There will surely be clergy as well, who will no longer be inspired by the love of Christ, but by material gain. Once material gain is at stake, we are ready for anything. Nothing would any longer prevent them from standing as traitors both of the faith and of the church. These will be the spiritual offspring of Cain and of Judas. The Apostle Paul notes, but know this. He says to Timothy, that in the last days, perilous times shall come. Difficult times will arise. For men shall be lovers of self, lovers of money, unholy. They will hold nothing holy and nothing sacred, slanderers, traitors. 2 Timothy 3:1-4. The Lord meant this betrayal when he said to his disciples, and brother shall deliver up brother to death, and the father the child, and children shall rise up against their parents, and shall put them to death. Matthew 10:21. This is the betrayal. Likewise, in the first Christian centuries, when the persecutions were taking place, they called traitors those who handed over the Holy Scriptures into the hands of the persecutors. Betrayal in this matter is the most loathsome thing, the most terrible. These people, as I told you, have the lot of a Judas. Thirdly, St. Cyril of Jerusalem notes in his 15th catechesis, which speaks of the Antichrist, the hatred of brothers for one another, frightens me. The hatred among these brothers frightens me, he says, and when he says brothers, he meant both the lay Christians and the clergy, and indeed the bishops, of whom he himself was the victim, because the one who ordained him Bishop of Jerusalem became an Arian and persecuted St. Cyril relentlessly, because he remained in orthodoxy. And he says, the hatred of brothers frightens me. What does this mean? It means that among our clergy, of all ranks, we will have the traitors of the faith who will always constitute the harlot church. Forgive me for saying it this way. The church, putting the word church in quotation marks, the harlot that unlawfully couples with the red beast, which is not only every atheist regime, but also every worldly condition, any worldly state whatever, this coupling, the unlawful coupling of church and world. Fourthly, St. Cosmas of Aetolia, in his prophecy number 56, the numbering according to His Eminence Augustinos of Florina, the numbering from his book, number 56, says the following. A time will come when this harmony that exists today between the people and the clergy will no longer exist. In number 57, the clergy will become the worst and the most impious of all. And in number 108, he notes, a time will come when Christians will rise up one against another. When will this happen? The Christians, not in the sense of political parties and political oppositions, but in the sense that this one will remain faithful, while that one has betrayed it, and the traitor Christian will persecute the faithful Christians. Fifthly, the ancient fathers used to say they were asked many times what would become of these things, and the divine ascetics said that the clergy would be just like the laity, that is, just as a layman moves and acts in his own interests, nothing else, so too, he says, will the clergy be. Sixthly, this reality I read, my beloved, in the biography of Father Demetrios, Gagastathis, a priest who was here in Tricola. If you read there, you will see the following, that the Metropolitan of Kozani, the one who was at that time, a contemporary matter in our own age, in keeping with the condition of the times, persecuted him and sought to put him to death. Who, a bishop, persecuted the priest, persecuted him and sought to put him to death. I will not tell you more. Read the voluminous tome of the biography of Father Demetrios Gagastathis, who had the reputation of a holy man, and you will see many things there. What does all of this mean, my beloved? It means that all of these things truly lend strength, alongside the interpretation about the harlot Rome, to also putting forward the interpretation that the harlot of Revelation represents the secularized church. And I said this, not because what this little book writes made a great impression on me, but rather because we truly observe this mystery of lawlessness being accomplished. Clergy, Orthodox, Christians, I do not say Roman Catholics, I do not say Protestants, to agree and form alliances with godless worldly situations and powers and regimes. Any of them, to be precise, left and right, red and green and yellow and black and white, left and right, whatever it may be, to go along with them, to agree with them, and to betray the church. This is a sign of the times. For Saint Cyril of Jerusalem, it is a sign of the times that the Antichrist is coming, when the clergy reach the point of betraying the very church herself. My beloved, may God have mercy on us.